This is George Ibbotson, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 8th of June 2012. George Ibbotson, Part 1.
For my sins, I was named George Rex Ibbotson because I was born on the Silver Jubilee of George V and Queen Mary, and I consider myself lucky that they didn't name me Mary. And I was born on the 6th of May 1935 in Plymouth.
So now you are how old?
77.
What does your dad do for a living?
My dad actually came from Yorkshire. He was a Leeds man initially, but his father died early on and he was put into care, which he didn't like, his foster parents. So he ran away and lied about his age and joined up as a band boy in the Royal Marines. And so he did his full tour, I suppose 22 years, something like that, in the Marines, and came out. And then in World War II, he was called up again into the Marine Band because the regular bandsmen were released for active duty. And so he used to, and they say they used to play in the theatres in lieu of a civilian band, civilian orchestra. And then eventually he came out of the Marines post-war and went to work in the Naval Engineering College as a steward.
What was his name, George?
Harry.
Harry Ibbotson.
Harry Ibbotson. Hmm.
Was he a well-educated man?
No, no. It was. I know my mother was the same. She had a note from the school or the education authorities at 15 to say that she had reached the required standard and could now go out into the wide world and earn a living. So no, I mean, say he ran away when he was about 15, and lied obviously to say he was 16, but it came back to caught up with him because. When it came to pension, of course, he had to wait an extra year to catch up.
So there's a musical streak in the family, is there?
Yes, I would say so. I would say I had piano lessons, obligatory piano lessons. I didn't get very far. My sister had them. She didn't get very far. My mother used to play on the piano a bit if she could. And she was a great fan of the music hall, so she was certainly in her head. Anyway, she's passed on that on to me. And nowadays, I always maintain that whatever subject you pick, there is a song written for it. So it always keeps them amused down at the church whenever I come out with a song for something, burst into song. So I like music.
What was your own career path?
Beg your pardon?
What was your own career path, John?
Well, I was at still at grammar school, and I sat the exam for the scientific civil service, and I was called for an interview, and I put down on my preference of career atomic energy, which would have been at Aldermanston, and in hindsight, I think the world survived my getting my hands on an atomic bomb. So, but at the same time, I belonged to a youth club, and the man who ran it was deputy headmaster at one of the local schools, and he said, "Have you ever considered the Met Office?" I said, "No." He said, "Would you like me to arrange an interview?" And the interviews were local in those days, so I said, "Yes." I went to the local Met Office, I was accepted, and the end of story. So 43 years later, I retired from the Met Office.
Well, first of all, then, what was it that intrigued you about the atomic industry?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose it was somewhat in its heyday then. It was new. It was not that long after the war, really, when we saw the destruction it could cause. But it was new, and it was possibly, in my mind, thought that might be the way forward for a career. You might have a decent career structure that you could advance through it. But as I say, in the end, I have no regrets that I took the path that I did, because I can honestly say, sort of 99% of the time, I had job satisfaction. There was a small 1% where I was square pegging a round hole and I didn't like it. But apart from that, I think that was worth it more than anything, really.
So had you had an interest in the weather before this suggestion came up?
No. It was something that had never crossed my mind. So really, when it suggested to me that I might like to try the Met Office, it was just another job. But I liked the look of it when I went and had a look around the office and what was involved. and my interest just grew after that.
Where was the office?
It was at RAF Mountbatten in Plymouth, which had been a seaplane base during the war, anti-submarine place. It started off as RNAS Catwater. Then the RNAS emerged with the RFC to become the Royal Air Force. So then it was RAF Catwater and finally named RAF Mountbatten after a captain, later Admiral Batten, who fought during the Civil War.
What was it that made you enjoy it, do you think?
Well, it was the variety. Initially I was a scientific assistant and I was plotting charts and doing observations. Then I did my national service abroad in Germany. And then I came out of there and, as I said in my notes, that I had always seen the circular going around, a vacancy notice with FIDS. And I said, one of these days I'm going to do that. It's one of my rash moments. I had a propensity for volunteering, which didn't always turn out right. But so as soon as I came at the RAF, I volunteered and that was it. I was down in FIDS for 2 years. And then I came out of FIDS and I went back and I was working in the Central Forecasting Office at Dunstable. I didn't really fancy that too much, so I volunteered for weatherships. So I went on weatherships for 3.5 years, came out of there, then I went to Cyprus and got married. So I spent a little tour of duty in Cyprus, came back, and then I moved. I was at Heathrow, then Cardiff Airport, and then I went out to Mazir, which is an island in the Arabian Sea. Then we went as a family to Germany for 3 years. And then I came back to the UK, and then it was civil aviation, military aviation, and then finally commercial services. And eventually I ended up in charge of the Weather Centre at Plymouth. At home.
Tell me about the weather ships, because they're not not around these days, are they?
No, they're defunct nowadays. It all goes back to, I think it was about 1933. I may be wrong, it might have been more like 37. And when Amy Earhart was lost in the Pacific, and they instituted a vast search for her. And President Roosevelt decreed that because there was nothing for her to home in on, that weather ships or something should be there and to help in the North Atlantic as well. And the British didn't really start till, I think they might have been something before the war, but I'm not sure about that, but till 1948. And it was possibly partly funded by under the umbrella of Air Sea Rescue. Because by my mind, the positions that the ships were placed were on the transatlantic routes, so that one of the things that was given by the deck officers was ground speed checks and position, so that, I mean, in later years with the jets and satellite navigation, it was the other way round. They were telling us where we were. Which wasn't a bad thing, actually. But we were 3 weeks on station, plus the time it took to get out there and back, which for most of them was 3 days each way. But there was one in the Denmark Strait between Greenland and Iceland that was 5 days each way, 3 days there. And I've got to pause now and think what else I was going to say. About the weather ships. Anyway, yes, that's right. We were positioned within a grid. There was a on station was the centre of the grid, and then it was 100 mile square around. And if it was bad weather, you steamed upwind, and then stopped and drifted back. Or even in bad calm, there was always you always floated anyway. So you would steam into a downwind, so that the current would bring you back on station.
So the ships weren't at anchor then, were
no,
they?
Not anchor, no. I can always remember, which one of the things that used to amaze me, because the deck officers, or certainly the first officer on the ship I was on, said, oh, you know, it's not like deep sea. And I said, deep sea? we've got 9,000 feet of water underneath us. How much deeper do you want it to be? But that was it. You see, if you didn't go to the Far East or down to Australia or something, you hadn't gone deep sea. You know, it's nonsense. I suppose they were on the continental shelf just about, but nonetheless. But yes, so to anchor would have been a bit of a problem.
Yeah. So just talk about the routine then. It was, say, 3 to 5 days sailing out, 3 weeks on board.
Yeah.
3 to 5 days sailing back. How long did he get back on dry land as a break?
About a week, maybe. If it was the long trip up to Station Alpha in the Denmark Strait, you might end up with, say, 10 to 14 days. But ultimately, at the end of the year, you had accumulated quite a bit of leave because you were working. There was a financial benefit because you were working. It was manned 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all the time you were out there. So you were working all weekends and ever. But no, at the end of the year, you could come ashore with accumulated leave. And we had one chap on there who'd been on just about since 1948, an Irishman. And he accumulated so much leave that he used to take at least one trip off, and he would go around all the international rugby games. And he could take a month or 2 months off. He could afford to do that.
Was it a good life?
Yes, it was rough at times. And necessarily, I mean, see, you can't expect to stick yourself out in the middle of the Atlantic or even on the fringes and not meet bad weather. I can remember the first trip I did. We went one, which is, I would say, west of Finisterre, somewhere like that. And we had quite a storm there. And one of the instruments on board was a wave recorder. It was accelerometers mounted on the hull. And it was scaled on a chart. And the pen moved backwards, forwards over the chart to give you the depth, the height of the waves. And the scale was up to 65 feet and it went off the scale. So, you know, I am totally unmoved when I hear about these horrendous seas.
This was, of course, was after you'd been to the Antarctic, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
So was there anything that you kind of, any experiences or techniques or anything you learnt in the Antarctic which you found yourself using in the Weatherships?
The only reason I got onto the Weatherships was because I'd been doing radio sonde. And I was sent to Base F, which was what we called a static base. There was no surveying in that one. We were a scientific base. And I had been sent by FIDS down to the radio sonde station at Camborne for a very brief course in radio sonde. So when I came back, I had done 2 years radio sonde. I had 2 years radio sonde experience, and that allowed me to go on Weatherships because we did 4 flights a day on Weatherships as opposed to the 1 a day down in FIDS.
Is it balloon releases, you mean?
Pardon?
When they say flights, do you mean balloon releases?
Balloons, yeah. Balloon launches, yeah. Yeah. So, I'd say basically at Base F, we did 1 a day. That was the routine, but in 1957 was the IGO, International Geophysical Year, and we were asked to do a second one in the evening, 12 hours away. So it was eight a.m. and 8 p.m., which is midnight and midday GMT.
Okay. Well, we haven't got you to the Antarctic yet, so let's talk about how you got there. Tom, you applied for the job.
Yes.
As a meteorologist.
Yes.
One of the few Met men who actually was a Met man, I would imagine.
Well, yeah. Yes, that's, and no. I mean, see, Don McNair was a Met man, and Evan Rowland Hughes was a Met man, but that was it. The other one, Roger Todd White, was taken on as a meteorologist, but he didn't have a career as such. I had to go up to London, and recently, when it was mentioned Milbank on the television news, and I remember very well 4 Mill Bank, where the Crown agents were, and going along, and I think it was John Green was one of the interviewers. And the question is, do you like cooking? And such like.
Yeah.
So that was it. I don't suppose there was much doubt, and that, you know, unless I'd made a complete and utter fool of myself, that I would get in anyway. So It was the first year of the Shackleton.
Well, they were short of Met men, weren't they? Which is why they were recruiting people who did other things. Then
well, I can only assume that was the case. I didn't have any know that at the time necessarily, and certainly when I met Don McNabb, and I assumed that they were all going to be Met men. But I met Roger Todd White at Camborne, and he was sent there as well. And I can remember Roger unpacking his washing from his last digs, all wrapped in newspaper, soggy newspaper. and we lodged at a local pub. And I learnt to play euchre. And I learnt to play it well enough to earn my drinks.
What's euchre?
Oh, it's a card game.
Oh, right, okay.
But it's very popular. It was very popular in Cornwall anyway. Hmm.
What was it that made you want to go to the Antarctic? I mean, what sort of knowledge did you have about it?
Well, I suppose the only thing I'd seen was Scott of the Antarctic, which everybody's just about seen.
Yeah.
And it had it a fascination, if you like, of sorts. And I had read a book about Shackleton. I was intrigued, I suppose. It wasn't through what I knew, it's what I didn't know. And I wanted to find out what it was all about. And I certainly did. And I tell people that when I came back that I can understand the fascination that the Antarctic held for the early explorers.
How do you mean?
Well, it's raw, nature in its rawest state, and the elements. It's just absolutely, fascinating, I found, really. The weather that you didn't see at home, but the beauty of the scenery, everything really, and the fauna that down there, the animal life, people. Let me see, my nieces and nephews were asking me all about penguins and seals and what have you, and regaled them with stories, maybe a little bit embellished from time to time, but it's what they wanted and what they got. But yes, it was the favourite American word. It was awesome.
It's very topical, that word, just now. It's used a lot by nieces and nephews, I've noticed. Yeah. So had you then harboured a desire to go?
Beg your pardon?
Had you harboured a desire to go?
Oh. I'm not sure. Can you rephrase that?
Well, did you have an ambition to go to the Antarctic?
Well, only in the sense that I'd seen these vacancy notices, or the trawls, that on behalf of Crown agents that the Met Office did. And it gave a synopsis of what was required and what you might be expected to do. And a number of times, like FIS, if you like, was the first one that I volunteered for. The second one I volunteered was Weatherships. Well, the first one, the first one was Weatherships. That was in 1952 when I didn't know Radio Somme then. And when I arrived on board over Christmas, they wondered why they bothered to send me, because I didn't know anything about Radio Somme. But I did learn. So that was a volunteer. FIS was a volunteer. Weatherships a volunteer. Then overseas I volunteered, so I spent a good part of my career volunteering.
All right. Do you feel also you were going south after you'd done your national service?
Yes.
So you were demobbed in 55.
55, yes.
So again, did that kind of experience, that national service experience, prepare you in some way for the kind of living style?
Well, yes, I suppose in a way it did. For many years, until such time as I met and married my wife, I had always been in male company. And so the RAF, we were sharing billets. Yes, that started me off, if you like. Then FIDS, even more cheek by jowl, we were living there, and we had to get on, which we did do. There was no arguments, really. It was amazing. And then, of course, Weatherships, again, was all male company. And we survived that. And so then it was, like I say, I came ashore and went to Cyprus.
Tell me about what do you remember the interview, apart from Johnny Green being there?
Eric Salmon was, Was Eric? Eric might have been in Stanley at the time. He hadn't married Frieda at that time. I was lodged with. We were taken off the Shackleton in Stanley and lodged with Ron Tapp, with a widow, an elderly widow. I always remember this because she had to go into hospital for something and leave us, and she'd left food already. And when she came out, it was only a short stay, she was surprised. She'd left two cooked chickens that we hadn't eaten one each. And she was surprised that we could survive on one chicken. and another thing that I developed a toothache in Stanley, and I went to see the dentist, which was a young German dentist. And he said, "You've got mutton teeth," because nothing unusual, but people, you're not used to eating so much meat, mutton. It may be lamb at Christmas, but so it's a new phrase to me, mutton teeth.
What was Stanley like in the 50s?
Well, it was new to me. I remember the FRC store. There was Binney's, I believe. Binney's was another storekeeper. I'm sure it was Binney's, because that's where I bought my camera. It was more on the way out, I think. It was interesting because we had been deprived. We had a park company with our civilian clothes in Stanley, and we were kitted out. And when we came back, we were given our clothes, civilian clothes, and we put them on. And, of course, nothing fitted because we put on so much muscle in that one down on base. And we were invited to the governor's cocktail party. And a right shower we looked, I think.
So, just, I've not heard this before. Your ordinary day clothes were taken from you?
Yeah, put in a kit bag and kept in store in Stanley.
For 2 years?
Because there was no need for them on base, and no room for them on base, really, for 2 years. And then you just hoped that the rats hadn't got to them, you know.
So the stuff you were given, was that ex-Army stuff?
Ex-Army, ex-Navy. Let's put it this way, ex-WD.
Yeah.
Because the jumpers and... Well, yes, yeah, it was a mixture. And the initially, you didn't have ski boots. You had army boots, and you put you had to wear just for skiing. And actually, you had no. But I believe the second year round, we were kitted out with slightly better gear. They sent some bits and pieces down. I don't know where I think they must have sent it down. Because certainly I remember Ron Tapp wearing army boots, but I remember coming out with ski boots, which I passed on to somebody else. So
was the clothing you were being given better than the clothing you were wearing previously?
Well, no. I mean, see, at that time, money was short. That if I remember rightly, the salary for the average FID was about £300-odd. Because I was a civil servant, I don't know, it was both years or the last year, I got my civil service salary out of it. So I was rather better off than most. But the running of FIDs, by the present day standards, was on a shoestring. Mm. The bulk of it, the money must have gone into provisions, I would think, because all the food and fuel. And so they were grateful. They probably got it a job lot, maybe free, a lot of the XWD clothing.
But I'm just intrigued as to why they felt that they had to give you their clothing when they could have just asked you to wear your own.
Our personal clothing wouldn't have been suitable for the climate.
Right.
Anoraks as such were, well, you it was more like a smock. You had to put it on over your head. It was not windproof. You wore a duffel coat inner underneath it. And you had, I don't know if they still issue mucklucks, but mucklucks was about the only word I could answer and call my bluff.
Just describe your mucklucks to me.
They were canvas, they were an Eskimo piece of a garment, a pair of boots, canvas boots, up knee length. Inside of which you had an inner, which was a felt bootie, and then your sea boot stockings, and then the boot on top. And it was a rubber sole, which was ridged. I don't suppose for a moment that the original Eskimo mukluks were anything like it. They were probably made of fur or sealskin or something like that. But nonetheless, for trudging around, they were adequate. It saved you having to put on skis because there were quite big footprints you left. But, yeah, mukluks. I've got a photograph of myself wearing mukluks. but most of the gear, I mean, see, the skis were clapped out. The bindings were clapped out. When Joe and others came down, they brought in new skis. And they were entirely different. A lot of their equipment, second year, they had moved up a notch. I think that possibly the funding by Crown agents was sufficient to allow them to improve on the equipment. And nowadays, of course, it's unbelievable. The stuff I saw down at Bass and came unbelievable.
Just to mention that Joe was Joe Farman, who we'll talk about later on. You mentioned Joe, that was
Joe. Oh yeah, Joe came down on the second year.
Yeah.
I think his cohort was maybe a little bit in awe of him because Joe let him know who was in charge, more or less. But then they had a hut on base, separated by about a quarter of a mile, and it was lined inside with copper. So the seismographs and the other instruments that were magnetically sensitive were inside. And Joe started things up again because they'd missed a year because the previous person doing it had decided to go home early. So I think they only stayed for a year, Joe. But he was rather unwise, and you may or may not want to use it. I think I said that when we... Ron Tapp and I, around midwinter, I suppose, in 57, we got clearance to go manhauling. And we were going to go across the channel, which would be, 5 miles, maybe more, somewhere to a depot. But the sea ice conditions were a bit questionable, so we didn't manage it. And... we didn't go where we intended to go, and the radio hadn't worked from day one, so nobody knew where we were. And Joe decided, in his wisdom, to bring us some fruitcake. he took a dog with him, I suppose, on the premise that if the dog didn't go through, he wouldn't. But he was wrong. The dog didn't go through, but he did. And so he had an ice axe with him, and he kept on chipping away at the ice edge, trying to pull himself out, and eventually he did, but it was for touch and go, I think, because it was breaking off. And so then he had to make fast tracks back to base, and he suffered a bit of frostbite on his hands, I think, because of the cold water.
That was a close call for Joe.
It was a close call for Joe, yes. I mean, see, it was a tacit agreement, I suppose it was an unwritten rule, that you never went out on sea ice by yourself.
But he did.
He did. So, that Joe was a law unto himself, unfortunately. But anyway, he survived, and he's still going. Mm. But, I would say we got on fine. As I said before, you know, it's amazing. You get this mixture of personalities that come along, and all right, you may have a bicker at some time, but you never really fell out. You couldn't afford to anyway.
Did you know from the outset you were going to be sent to Argentine Islands?
No.
When did you find out?
I suppose when I got the Stanley, I suppose. Obviously I knew it was to do with Radio Son because they wouldn't have sent me to Camborne otherwise, but I had no idea where the Radio Son place would be. In fact, we were put to work in Stanley, helping out in the office there because we were more up to date with the latest rules, Met Office rules and that, so we were able to brief them, or I was able to brief them on the way of procedures and what have you. I can't remember. There must have been Sandy. They told me really, and that's when I met Ron Tapp and knew that he was going there as well. And I knew Roger Todd White was going this because he'd done the Radio Song training as well.
Hmm. So what was the Met Office at Stanley like in 1957 or so?
What am I trying to... It was Pat somebody or other in charge. He was... I don't know. So it was overseas station. It was regarded, if you like another overseas station, and it would have a principal scientific officer in charge. And Pat was, I think he was a PSO in charge. But they were all, it was Met Office manned. There were one or two locals who were trained locally. But one of the ones that came was an ex-FID. He came to Paddy Byrne. He'd gone back to the UK from FIDS, got married, asked to come back to Stanley, and they said yes. So he came back with his wife and a big crate containing all his furniture. But I, at the end of my 2 years, I signalled Pat, whatever his name was, and said, any chance of me stopping off on Stanley for a tour for a year on the way back? He said, certainly, no problem. He contacted headquarters, Met Office headquarters. No way. No way. So that was the end of that. I didn't do a tour in Stanley. Mm. But
you were suggesting that the equipment at Stanley was not the latest equipment. It was a bit backward, was it?
No, far from it, no. But the point is that the procedures, radio sound procedures for computing and what have you, had changed, had been added to. And I don't know whether it hadn't reached them yet, but anyway, I was able to brief them on what was to be expected.
So what were those latest developments then?
Well, it was the fact that at highest altitudes, where the elements, the temperature elements in particular, was exposed directly to radiation, solar radiation, it might give a wrong reading, or as opposed to when you're reading it off on a calibration curve. So you had to apply corrections, add a few degrees on, take a few degrees off to allow for the solar radiation. It was somebody did, and then in later years they scrapped it. It was somebody who justified the existence by kind of, oh, I think it's, you know, it needs correcting or what have you, but there we are.
So it was a new calibration as such, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because what you did is each transmitter came with a chart with the three calibrations curves on it, one for temperature, pressure and humidity, and effectively you redrew those, applying the corrections, certainly the temperature curve anyway, you redrew it. So you had to have ships curves to draw all the dots up.
So the radio sonde training you had in your national service?
No.
None?
No.
Where was the training you took? Where do you learn the techniques of radio sonde?
In Camborne, prior to going to FIDS.
Right, so you've been appointed, then you were sent to Camborne?
Yes.
To train?
Yeah.
Right.
And then when I came back, as I say, to Dunstable and asked to go on weatherships, the person in charge of that section of the Met Office said, but you've never done a radio sonde course. I said, well, no, but I've done it for 2 years. That's not good enough. You've got to do the radio sonde training. So I was sent to Hemsby to do the course there and then straight on to ships. And when I got to Hemsby, the instructor said, you've done this before, haven't you? And I told them the story. And they said, well, you know, what do you want to do with yourself? You know, you're wasting your time here. Mm. But anyway, that's the way the rules were written in, engraved in stone. You will do a radio song course before you're let loose.
Mm. Okay, so you set sail from Stanley to go south.
Yes, on the old John Biscoe.
The wooden boat.
The wooden sheathed one.
Yeah.
That's what I understood. I always thought that it was wooden sheathed to allow it to be resilience going through ice, I think. But then they sold it to the New Zealanders back, didn't they? Gave it back to New Zealand when they finished with it. When they built the new John Biscoe, which is what I came home on, it was cramped, you know, but it was what FIDS had been used to. Mm. Because up to then, they'd chartered a lot of ships, and Kisterdan, the Megadan. And it was that design that the first Shackleton was based on, really. It was just one of the Dan ships renamed RRS Shackleton. But instead of having two to a cabin, you were sort of wearing hammocks virtually on the old Visco. It was very cheap by Joel. Very.
Was that all right?
Oh, yes. It was the camaraderie, you know, when they're going down, all laughs and jokes. There was a number of ex-Fids down for another tour. I think it was Lofty Wurzwick was one who was again, back again and again and again. Mm. And, of course, Ron Tapp had been down before, and I believe he'd come down to earn money to get married off with. And then we stopped at Deception in Admiralty Bay, Hope Bay, and then the next stop, I don't think we stopped at Anvers, I think we just went straight down to Base F.
What was it like then, Argentine Island, in 56? Back in the 56, wasn't it?
Different from anything I'd experienced, but it was just everything was new, of course. Not, I say, not in the sense that it was pristine. It was new to me. Mm. And get used to it and working out a routine, who was going to do what. And it had to be sorted out fairly quickly, sort of who's going to be cook for the Sunday, because Jerry Cutland was a cook initially. I don't know whether he did 7 days a week, but certainly eventually he had Sundays off. So that the rota had to be sorted out for that. The rota out for the toilets and the general maintenance and humping coal and bringing up the all the usual jobs. In fact, so each thing was new to me. Starting a diesel engine by cranking it in a temperature of -5 or something like that. But yes.
Let's talk about two or three of your colleagues. Then you mentioned Jerry Cutland, who went on to produce the Fid cookbook, didn't he? Fit for a Fid.
Sorry, he was what?
Is it not Jerry Cutland that produced the Fid's cookbook?
Oh, yeah, the Penguin book. Yes, yeah. Yeah, I think it was. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think I told you that Jerry had been in the Control Commission in Berlin, I think, post war, and when he came out of the army, he owned first one and I think second. In Biddeford, North Devon, Snackmar. And he taught himself pastry cooking so he could make all the cakes for his shops. Mm. So that meant that he came down with no preconceived ideas and he could take whatever ingredients were there and adjust a recipe from all the recipe books that were there to suit the ingredients. And it was absolutely superb. It really was. It was suggested at the end of the 2 years that he put some of these recipes together. And I've never seen the book, I must admit. I looked around for it, but I could never find it. But
it's been reissued.
Reissued, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Because I was his butcher, you see.
How do you mean?
Well, I was the base butcher. If it came to seals and what have you, ostensibly for dog food, but I would extract the offal. Not that everybody would eat it, you know. I never touched the kidneys. We did the liver, did the heart. At one time we tried the brains, but there's only two of us would try that. And the Chateaubriand.
The what?
The fillet steak.
Oh, right, okay.
Right down the backbone here, either side. And it, you know, that long and about that round. About, let's put it, say, about 3 inches thick and about 12 inches long and regarded as fillet steak.
Did some of the Fids then turn their noses up at...
Yes. They had to make do with what the alternative was. And on the way back home, Jerry was asked by the skipper or somebody anyway, maybe the chief steward, if he would cook a meal for everybody on board, which he did do. Unfortunately, I would say that the deckhands and the greasers and what have you, what they wanted was something solid to keep them going, you know. So salmon vol-au-vents and that didn't really go down. Didn't go down. And he had me go down. We just loaded a load of sails and that to on deck, you know, to go up to Hope Bay or somewhere to go and extract some fillet steak and what have you. And, he went down like a lead balloon. It really did.
What about his food on base, though? Was he producing posh nosh on base?
By comparison with the other bases, I've no doubt at all. It really was. You couldn't fault it. I mean, his spaghetti bolognese was one of our favourites. And you see, he made fresh bread every day, fresh rolls for lunch. And it wasn't tin soup. It was tin soup made out of tin veg, maybe, like asparagus or what have you. He made pastries for afternoon tea. It was always very much Lion's Corner House in the afternoon.
So what was the ball in the spag bol? Was that bony filet meat or was that more seal?
What was that, sorry?
What was the ball in the spag bol? Was it bony filet meat?
Well,
or was
I kind of think that. I suppose it was. It must have been tin steak. I mean, so we used to get tin brisket.
Yeah.
And we used to get tin steak or something else as well. That's all I can think of, really. It's but anyway, it went down a charm.
Did he ever tell you why he gave up the snack bars in Biddeford to go south?
No. No, I don't. I never did find out. Whether it was a sixth sense or no, that decided he didn't want to talk about it, I don't know. I don't know, but none of us ever really broached it, I think.
Some of your other colleagues you've made notes about here. Ron Tapp, you've mentioned already, he was a...
He had been a dental technician, as far as I know, in UK, still was. But he'd been down before, I don't know which base, but... the word was from Ron that he was going to go back and get married, so he needed a dowry to take with him.
Right.
So he was down for the second time. But the fact that he'd been a dental technician was reflected in his skill with the tools and model making and what have you. It's very, very good indeed.
What did he make?
Sledges.
Model sledges?
About a foot long. Yeah. It was the remnants of an old ski. He'd cut it down, he'd, you know, plane it and sand it, and it was very, very good indeed. So, I went to Worthing once in the hope, and I, with every intention of looking in the telephone directory and see if I could find him, but I never did. Mm. But so I don't know where Ron is, if at all, whether he's still with us.
Mario Nantes.
Mario. again, it was purely by word of mouth, not that Mario told us, but that he had worked in the British Embassy in Montevideo, Uruguayan, obviously. I don't know what job he could have had in the British Embassy, because as far as we were concerned, he didn't speak a word of English when he came down. He was a charming chap, so unassuming. Do anything you asked him to. We used to get him, he used to help out with the filling of balloons and that. He could do that fine. He made a mess of it once or twice, that's fine. When he skied, you could climb to the top of Duglindus and you had a straight run right down the bottom to the sea. And if Mario was coming down, you just got out the way, because there was no way Mario could stop other than falling over. He never did master skis. And there's a wonder at the bottom when it flattened out and went scuttering towards the sea that he never ended up in the sea as well. But very nice bloke. He did learn English, not all the right kind of English, because I don't know which shop it was, but it was told that he went, when we were coming out off base in Stanley, he went in and used a few expletives and was asked to leave the shop. I don't think we pointed him in the right direction. And he met up with us when we got to Montevideo. He went to see his family first, obviously, and then he came with us and joined in with us in the evening to see us off on that next day. But he ended up in the UK for a while anyway. He was sent to Hemsby Radio Sound School for a course, and for all I know, he might have done other courses, but he didn't do any meteorology on base, so he might well have done an observing course as well. And the suggestion was that he was destined for great things in the Uruguayan Met Office, even directorship. I don't know. I never did find. But the Met Office grapevine is that in Hemsby, in the local village hall, I suppose, of the dances, this suave Latin Lothario would stroll in, and all the young ladies there would swoon. But eventually he married one.
An English girl?
He married an English girl, so and she obviously went back to Monte with him. So I think somebody said she was a blonde, which, considering how dark he was, and I can remember on bass once that we inadvisedly, just for a short distance, I went skiing in shorts and no shirt. Well, it doesn't matter about that. It was a shorts. It didn't go far, but it was enough to get sunburnt. And Mario laughed his head off, "You blancos." So he went skiing with no shorts and got sunburnt. And he couldn't understand how, when he, as dark as he was, how he got sunburnt, but he did. So we never let him live that down.
You also got some notes here about Don McNabb.
Don McNabb, yes. He was, he liked to imbibe, which he couldn't do as much as he would have liked, maybe. So at the end of the first year, it was Colonel somebody in charge of the Canadian forces, it must be, I don't know, Met Service, had approached Fitz asking if they had anybody suitable who would they could recruit to go and work at Knoblake University, Knoblake Observatory, which I believe is in Newfoundland, I'm not sure. And it was Don was recommended, and off we went. And we thought, oh my Lord, what have they let themselves in for? But he did a graduate course at McGill University, sandwich course, and he obviously excelled, because at the end of whatever period it was, Fids were asked if they had anybody else of a similar calibre. So we. Shock horror. Don is obviously a changed man. He came back, he got married, and he went to work in the Channel Island Met Service. And while I was, I used to speak to the Channel Islands when I was at Plymouth, because we worked with them when they were producing their BBC forecasts. And I asked about him, and they said, oh yes, he's still here, but he has retired. So I never did manage to get over and see him.
I met Clive Pearson earlier this year, who was
Cook. Oh, he came in the second. He came in 58.
In second year, yeah.
No,
that's right. 58.
At the end of the 50th, first year, second, end of the second year. That's right. He was there for 58.
Yeah.
Well, he was the complete opposite to Jerry Cutlan, because he had been taught to cook using certain ingredients, and I don't know what it was like at the end of 58, but at the beginning of 58, he couldn't cope, because he could not get his head around dried strip potatoes and everything else. And it's all in tins. He just couldn't hack it. But I hopefully he did a bit, you know. I think Jeremy gave him a bit of tuition and that, and helped him a bit. So hopefully by the end of the, or before the end of the year, you know, he managed to turn himself around.
So he was coming in whilst you were going out, is that?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a bit of an overlap, but yes, he as I say, he just couldn't hack strip potatoes.
There's a rumour goes around that one or two of the Fids were offered the option of moving on after their first year.
Yes.
But they stayed for Jerry's food.
Yes. Well, no, it's myself, Jerry and Ron Tapp.
Yeah.
I think it was just that we were buddy buddies. It was just the way it worked. We just got on so well. Of course, Jerry was a West Countryman, so we had to stick together. And I don't know why Jerry didn't choose to pick and move on. I don't know. But we were very fortunate to keep him. And I was doubly blessed to have him and Ron Tapp.
Tell me about the work you were doing then, because obviously the reason you were there was to do Met observations. So what was the regime like, George?
Well, apart from, it was 3 hourly observations, which were sent to Stanley.
How were they sent?
Pardon?
How were they sent?
Oh, by RT.
Morse code?
Yes. ZHF-88 was our call sign. That much I do remember, and I can even remember the Morse for it, but that's about all. And then at 8 a.m. local time, 0800, we did a radio song ascent. Somebody was responsible for filling up the balloon. And although we had a certain number of hydrogen cylinders, we also had a hydrogen generator. When we the one that was there in 56, the ingredients were magnesium iron pellets and water. Bearing in midwinter with temperatures so sub-zero, you had to carry a couple of buckets of boiling or water from the hot water from the base up across and hope it stayed warm enough to not freeze before we managed to get the generator going. The second year we had a new generator sent down, a Canadian one called a Jill generator, and that operated on aluminium flakes and caustic soda and water. And we had, the routine was that you measured out so much of each of the chemicals, put them into, unscrewed the plug, put a funnel in, poured it in, put the clamp on the hole, and then filled up the water tank above and opened the water tap, and away you went, and the hydrogen hopefully came out. When you'd finished, at the bottom of the generator, there was a lever that you were supposed to kick to flush out the generator. Somebody who shall remain nameless didn't do that. And I was the next muggins who had to go along the next day and do a balloon. I poured in the chemicals, but it was still fluid inside. So they all shot out in my face. And I had to go back and stick my head in a bucket of water to stop my head from generating hydrogen. So I felt a bit lightheaded for a while. So that was the generator thing. If in the event that we had a bad launch, then there was no way you could use a generator again. And that's where the cylinders came and you had dry hydrogen. But when you had to use a generator, there was supposed to be a drying, I don't know what it was, it couldn't have been silica gel. It was something, there was supposed to be, have a drying agent in so that the hydrogen went in the balloon dry. But inevitably that didn't work. So it went in wet. And so you had to tap the balloon gently on the sides to get all the ice to come down to the neck at the bottom and hopefully try to get some of it out anyway. But and then, in 57, the IGO and the IGY, there was a 2000 local 12 GMT ascent required as well. And then we had to write up all the results. It was more involved than just with the IGY than just doing the ascent and sending the coded message off to Stanley. We had actually to fill in umpteen pro forma, which would eventually have gone on the database in the UK.
Why was it important to have two readings a day for the IGY year?
To match the UK. The 8 a.m. was all that was needed by Stanley to do any forecasting. They might do forecasting for FIC, I don't know, for the whatever the ship was and whether it was a Darwin or not. And also there was a naval hydrographic survey launch around, or boat, and HMS Protector probably ran, the launch probably tied up with HMS Protector. So the Stanley would do forecasts for that. And even when they were down around the Argentine Islands surveying, we used to get a message from Stanley, do they want a forecast? But once the day was ended, they didn't need anything more. They didn't need one in the evening at 8 o'clock. It didn't serve any purpose. But to tie in with international requirements for IGY, we were asked to do the second one. So, and then when I came back to the UK and ended up at Dunstable, what job did I get? Checking all the, not from Argentina, but radio, all the British radio sound data for the IGY for the whole year, checking it and identifying errors and sending back to the station saying, will you check this and correct if necessary, which they did. And then having it typed out again and sort of then sent off to the WMO in Geneva.
What was the point of all that?
Well, I don't... It was... Well, I don't know what the outcome was, quite honestly, because it didn't limit itself to meteorology. The IGY, it was geophysical, would have taken in geology, I imagine, and seismography and what have you. It was obviously to study the climate to some extent, but 1 year doesn't tell you much at all. No. But it was something to... Because on a global basis, they had at least one ascent from all the radio sound stations in the world a day, and most of them maybe two. So what did they gain from the IGY? I honestly don't know, except insofar as I think we were issued that they tried to do one high altitude flight. In those days, balloon technology, the British balloon technology, was not very good. It was never very good. And they would possibly get to 40,000 feet, something like that. And they wanted to go higher, maybe 60, 70,000 feet. I mean, nowadays it's 100,000 feet. Balloon technology has improved so much. Mm-hmm. And the balloon manufacturer no longer exists. Much, I forget to say, my doing.
How do you mean?
Well, I was, when I came back, where was it from? From Germany. I was based at the, I was put as site manager of the experimental site in Bracknell, the Meadows experimental site. And I was also given a number of hats, a number of round holes to fit my square peg into, one of which was balloons, Met Office balloons. And I worked closely with the British manufacturers. But I could see, because we bought in balloons from other manufacturers just to see what they were like. And in the end, I went to tender for the next year. And when we bought Japanese ones, and they were absolutely marvellous balloons. And the audit commission say, why on earth haven't you been to a tender before? Because they were so much cheaper. Mm. But the point is that the company that made them used to make Philly stick-on soles, Phillips. And they'd been bought out by an entrepreneur, and he had a holding company, and one of them was this balloon manufacturer. And he managed to convince, and everything was done in old mills. He managed to convince Bury Council to allow him to build, build, if you like, a new factory in the town centre, which he did do. So when they stopped manufacturing, he was rubbing his hands with glee because he got the city centre premises, so he had to turn it to other use. And I don't know what it was, but one of these days I shall go to Bury and find out.
Okay. When all the... Back in the UK then, we're leaping about a bit, but it doesn't matter. You're back in the UK, you're given the job of going through all the IGY radio sound figures. Mm. Was that from all over the planet?
No, it's just the British ones. That would have been the UK, Gibraltar, Cyprus, maybe Al Adam at that time. Al Adam, yeah. I'm trying to think which other ones would have still been up. Stanley.
Aidan,
possibly.
Yeah.
Stanley. In other words, other ones, all the ones that were the Met Office funded or run, and the weather ships as well.
And Halley.
I can't remember, you know.
Okay. But so. But
they didn't do radio sound, did
I'm
they?
Asking you, I don't know.
No, I don't think they did.
Okay.
No.
So, but then there'd be somebody else, there'd be other Georges all over the planet doing the same thing, would they?
one would assume that each national body had somebody stuck away in an hour.
So it was a truly international project.
Yes.
And at the end of it, you had a snapshot of the condition of the planet.
Yes.
So perhaps in the end, it was all being done purely for science rather than for any applied.
Oh yeah, it was pure science rather than applied.
Yeah.
Yes, certainly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But I'd say I'm going to go and do a Google. and find out what they did with it.
Good idea. Did it ever present him any serious problems? Were there days when he simply couldn't do the sond releases?
The only time I ever remember missing a flight was on the Weatherships, when the captain forbade anybody to go on deck. The weather was so bad.
Oh, right.
He's battened down the hatches. But as far as Fids are concerned, I do believe there was one. I do believe there was one. I can't remember why it was. Obviously, I can only imagine that the first attempt had failed. But once.
But otherwise, it was very reliable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what other weather readings were you taking it apart from that? What other Met observations were you doing?
Well, we were doing what we call surface observations every 3 hours, which were, again, sent to Stanley. And no doubt ended on, well, I wouldn't say charts in the UK, maybe in the UK, I don't know. But places like like Australia, I suppose, if they were doing the circumpolar charts for the southern hemisphere, they would the observations would appear on there. Because certainly the UK, Met Office in the UK, does circumpolar charts and that to see what's coming. But yes, I would imagine as well that maybe somewhere like South Africa, in other words, because it was a west to east flow of the weather, they want to know what's coming as well. So, yes.
What were the characteristics of the weather patterns at Argentine at that time?
Well, it was, in a sense, it was like a winter and summer monsoon, if you could say, really, because all the snow came in the winter, and in the summer it all went, just about. The islands had a permanent ice cap. They never lost that. But though it was very, very wet and a lot of puddles. We gained something like 3 feet of snow, compacted snow, during the winter period. Because I remember that because coming out of the front door of the hut, you had to walk down several steps to get down to ground level, whereas in the winter you just stepped off the side. It was one of the problems was keeping the screen clean because of drifting snow, and it filled up with drifting snow. You had to clear that out. And one of the things that we had equipment that allowed us, we kept in the observation screen, and the idea was that you had a glass slide, I can't remember which order you did it in, and you put a snowflake on it, and you covered it with resin, and you were left with a cast of a snowflake. I don't think we were very successful with that.
Why was that?
Well, I think possibly because the snowflake melted. No, let me see. Supposedly, all the equipment being kept on the screen would all have been at the same temperature, so you could have picked up a snowflake. And that, but the point is that trying to keep a box of slides clear of snow and whatever, and that, I imagine the resin was evaporated and dried rather than it didn't freeze anyway. Well, I think we obviously had an element of success. It wasn't a total failure. But I was trying, I nearly said observed aurora, but we didn't, because we did used to do that on weather ships.
What was the reason for trying to preserve these snowflakes?
Well, I'm not sure, not quite sure. I mean, say the multitude, there is a multitude of different shaped crystals on the for snowflakes, and a snowflake is not a crystal, it's an amalgamation of crystals. So I'm not sure whether I was reading that there's one type of crystal that is present in every snowflake, but the rest of it, the formation, whether it's to correlate temperature, humidity, or whatever with the form of snowflake, there must be a reason why a snowflake forms in the shape it does. Mm. And I dare say that's what they were trying to... They may be correlating with other information that we provide in the way of weather observations. I don't know.
Did anybody ever perfect the art of catching snowflakes?
Not on Argentina. Oh, that's right. You had a piece of black velvet. And it's all these little bits come back to catch a snowflake on. So obviously you had to go out while it was snowing.
Yeah.
Which in itself, if the wind was blowing any strength, you know, was a problem in itself. So, yeah.
I remember learning at school that every snowflake was different. Is that?
That is, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I suppose that may well be true. Certainly, they're not just one snowflake.
Yeah,
there are a multitude of different shapes.
Yeah.
But the crystals that they're formed from, they must be the coalescence of those. It must be due to certain atmospheric conditions, I think, really, as well.
Was it windy?
Not exceptionally so. Well, we had blizzards, yes, but not exceptionally so. I've been in windier places, to put it that way. But windy enough. I mean, say, if you've got to go carrying two buckets of water across to the balloon shed and try to get in without, you know, snow drifting up the inside of the balloon shed, which it did anyway, the wind didn't help one little bit.
Let's pause, George.
Right. Can I get you a drink?
Yes.
Can I get you anything to eat?
No, but a drink would be lovely, a cup of tea.